Welcome back to Firewall. I'm your host, Bradley Tusk. It's a Tuesday episode, so with us is our friend and producer, Hugo Lindgren. Hugo, how you doing?
Hey, Bradley, you're getting to the end, or we're both getting to the end of our spring break here.
Yeah, so let's set some context to the listeners, because normally we record early Monday morning and Orchard Street is completely empty. It's 5:30 on a Saturday. You are in London right now?
I'm in Liverpool.
You're in Liverpool, so it's what, 10:30 there?
It is 9:30. The time changes in Liverpool tonight or in England.
Tonight. Oh, wow. All right. Yeah. Cut there just in time. You get to do it twice. Are you going to a soccer match? Is that why you're there?
Tomorrow, yeah. A football match, Bradley.
Football, right. Who will you see?
It's Liverpool and Brighton.
Who's favored? Is that the Premier League or no?
That's the Premier League, and Liverpool is at the top of the table. I think they're tied, actually. Maybe they're behind on goal differential, and Brighton is not. I mean, they're in the Premier League, but they're not at
the
top.
And the Champions League is what? The best of the Premier League from around Europe?
Yeah, the Champions League is the top European teams from a bunch of the different European leagues.
Right. So how many from the Premier League make the Champions League?
So I think there's four teams from the Premier League that go into the Champions. I think they might be changing it, or they keep talking about it, but the top four teams go in, and Liverpool did not make it. It's based on last year, so they're not in the Champions League this year.
So I have to say, I really do like this relegation concept that they have over there.
I know. It's good.
It would be interesting to incorporate that. If nothing else, what you wouldn't have are some of these bottom feeder owners in professional sports who, just because of revenue sharing, are just happy to collect, you know, the TV payments and everything else every year, bottom out the salary, just have shitty teams.
Well, you know, there's a guy, you've probably met him. He I think he's the guy who founded Foursquare. He's been trying to set up a kind of like soccer empire in the United States.
Dennis something. Yeah. I didn't know that, but I know his name is Dennis, though I don't remember his last name.
Yeah. It's cool. Actually, I've been up to see his team. They play up in Kingston, New York, and I really enjoyed it. I think he does a great job with it. It's very local. It feels like,
because the relegation is other people make it in, right? That's what's exciting about it. It's not just the stakes for losing, but then other people have hope, right? In the league below.
I mean, that's exactly. So you mentioned the first part of it, which is it provides this incentive for, you know, owners at the bottom to not, you know, whatever, just rake in the profits and not put a competitive team out there. But the other thing is that these smaller clubs have a chance to crack the top, and that's really exciting. And it, in England, it's just, you know, it's bananas. They love it.
Yeah. So it is. It's Saturday night, as I mentioned, and here on Orchard Street, there is a club right next to the studio called Mr. Purple that is seemingly very popular, and there are long lines to get in here. You know, Basil explained to me that people. Yeah, I was so surprised. But what do I know about young people?
If you were going to write a novel about a club on the Lower East Side, do you think Mr. Purple would be too dumb a name to make?
Well, first of all, it sounds derivative of Reservoir Dogs. Right. No, to me, like, the ultimate Lower East Side, like, a drinking venue for, like, a book would be Richard Price, the one on the cover of Lush Life, which, if you remember, I think we actually looked at that space.
We did, for the bookstore.
It didn't. Yep. It was a bar. It didn't work as a bookstore. What's also happening right behind us is it is Teen Poet open mic at P&T Knitwear. I just walked in and there were these sort of nice kids and families, and I was trying to figure out what was going on. And looked at the sign and saw that this was our night, the last Saturday of every month.
Wow, I feel so bad to be missing out on all this action on the Lower East Side. That sounds great.
Yeah, I know. You should be here. So anyway, here's what we're going to talk about. I think we had so much content. We've had this weird, like, overflow of content lately where we have to kind of keep pruning
Bradley,
topics.
You're on a roll. It used to be, I mean, we've always had plenty to talk about, but, like, often, like, you know, you're like, well, we don't have another one, and you're asking me for stuff. But, like, at least the last month, maybe longer, you've had, like, all these kind of, like, midweek inspirations where you send me these sometimes crazy things.
Skee-ball.
Anybody who listened to Skee-ball last week knows there's no bounds for what Bradley will deign to talk about on Firewall. But this week you've got another couple ones. They're not quite as out there as Skee-ball.
No, and you know what it is? I think now that each episode is a mix of topics of the day and then maybe some content that I've created, it has kind of got me rolling. So the first thing, though, is a topic of the day. And so we talked the other week, and it was sort of very tongue-in-cheek, about the idea of Aaron Rodgers being RFK's VP selection. RFK Jr. did make his selection. It's Nicole Shanahan, a Silicon Valley attorney and entrepreneur, a former wife of Sergey Brin, the co-founder of Google. And so she's 38. She is wealthy, although we don't know how wealthy, because clearly, you know, when she married Brin in 2018, they had, I'm sure, a pretty strong prenup. So it's not like she walked away with half of Google. But she might have walked away with $1 billion. We don't know. And she has been a supporter of RFK. She paid for the Super Bowl ad supporting him. And he's got her. And so to me, what was interesting here was less her in and of herself, but more, you know, I was thinking about if I were Trump, to me, her presence is a huge opportunity. So this is an RFK Trump conspiracy theory that is in no way, in my view, actually happening. So I'm not like accusing it of happening. I'm just saying
about that later, because I understand that this was a kind of a product of your imagination, but
yeah,
but,
I've been on QAnon.
I have some questions about the plausibility of all this.
No, it's not highly implausible though. That's the thing. So let me lay it out, which is,
I think it's highly plausible. But anyway, we're going to get to it.
If I'm Trump and I'm Kennedy, I cut a deal, right? And the deal is Kennedy knows, I assume, that he's not going to be the president, right? But he clearly relishes in attention as much as possible. And if you're Trump, you don't give a shit who's in your cabinet. You're running for president to stay out of jail, to stay out of bankruptcy, you know, whatever. Yeah. But by the way, getting people to work with you is going to be hard enough that RFK would be sort of average crazy for the Trump administration, not even really crazy. So the deal is this. You're Trump, and you say to Kennedy, all right, you get EPA, HHS, whatever thing interests you. Shanahan could have one too. Who cares? Got to keep it quiet, which probably RFK and Shanahan can do. I don't know that Trump is capable of that, but maybe he is when it's in his best interest. All right, so that's the first piece of the puzzle. The second would be Shanahan becomes a weapon for Trump, but from the far left. She goes super young, super woke, super anti-Israel, with the sole purpose of taking young voters on the left away from Biden and swing states. She's in no way explicitly pro-Trump. She doesn't really need to mention him one way or the other. It's all got to be just about, hey, you know, young, far-left voters, Joe Biden is not your guy. He is not progressive enough. He is, you know, not pure enough. I am, vote for me. She spends her time in 6 to 8 states, so Arizona, Nevada, North Carolina, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and doing national media, just attacking Biden as too conservative and too old. She goes on every podcast imaginable, talks to every reporter who wants to, just a constant stream of media, which, A, she will love. And while the media will try to trip her up on stuff, one, she's pretty smart, so I think she can be reasonably prepared for most of the issues that are going to come her way. Two, they're all in on the joke, so while, you know, some of them might want to trip her up, I think a lot of them like the idea of feeding the beast, so she's creating all of this extra content that they have something to cover. And three, or C, I forgot if I was using letters or numbers, you know, anytime that she does trip up, she can just say the mainstream media is trying to protect Biden, right? So she's kind of got it. Airtight either way. Number four, she just does event on college campus after college campus after college campus. I would do one every single day. They build on themselves, and the more attention each one gets, the more it drives attention to the next. That drives even more coverage.
Tell me why college campuses?
Because you'll get these young people who are very left-wing, already sort of conditioned to be, you know, anti-Israel, pro-Hamas, you know, pro-DSA, very ready to be whipped up into a frenzy. And they're just good cheering backdrops. So one is, yes, you want to try to get those people in those schools to vote for RFK, although a lot of them, keep in mind, aren't registered at the school that they're at. So depending on the school you're going to, it may or may not matter. And the more local a school, the more it's a commuter school, the less likely they are to be super far left and super receptive to this message. So it's less about getting students at the University of Arizona to vote for RFK, although it's some of that. And it's more just about, you know, driving media coverage, which drives social, which will drive Team Biden fucking crazy, right? And now they're off their game, or even more off their game than they already are.
Okay, so on to number five.
Number five. Kennedy does his thing to appeal to his crazies too, because, you know, no one votes for just the VP pick. There's like almost no evidence in history that that ever really happens. So he's got to still do all of his campaigning. I think sometimes he should join with her. And this actually, to me, is one of the bigger risks of this plan, which is she could end up getting more attention than he does, right? And even though he may understand that it's for his greater good of him getting a cabinet post or whatever, you could still see him getting jealous and undermining the whole thing. That's not atypical for politics. So, you know, if I were Team Kennedy and I were orchestrating this plan, I would be mindful of the fact that there is this risk of that. And again, I don't know the guy's personality. Maybe he is sort of secure enough that he can handle it. But if he were that secure, he wouldn't be running for office in the first place. And the last, and you tell me if you agree, because you are a member of the media. You know, I think the press is going to eat this shit up. She's young. She's rich. She's attractive. She was married to one famous guy. Their marriage allegedly ended because she had an affair with another famous guy, even more famous guy, Elon Musk. They'll love the attacking Biden from the left angle. It'll dominate Twitter. So I just kind of think that it becomes this easy to create, endlessly self-sustaining effort that just drives the anti-Biden vote on the left among younger voters. And if we're talking about 10, 20,000 vote differentials in half a dozen states as potentially the margin of difference in the election, that could be really meaningful. So, look, I hope none of this happens because I'm for Biden. But if I were Trump and Kennedy, I would cut this deal.
Well, but to me, so you sent me this, and my first reaction was like, this doesn't feel like a conspiracy at all. This feels like if they're serious about, so if RFK and Shanahan are serious about running, which it sounds like they are, what else would they do but this?
Well, you could
see they might not be smart enough to follow it. They might get distracted.
The question is that both of those sides have to realize it's in their interest. They may believe that ultimately they don't want Trump to win, and therefore while they think that they should win, they're not going to sort of conspire with Trump. Or they may worry about, you know, their place in history if that becomes found out, because everything eventually does become found out.
But isn't this just politics? Like, of course, especially if you're running a long shot, like third party thing, right? You're not going to win, as you said. So you're going to get what?
You get attention, but that's why they're running. So here's the thing. The efficacy of it, though, requires it to seem genuine, right? It has to be that Shanahan is going at Biden from the far left, not as a proxy for Trump, but right. as their own campaign, right? And so I think that if the conspiracy or the deal or whatever you want to call it becomes known, then I think it will be far less effective, because if the media doesn't take it seriously, it doesn't mean anything. They may hear a million whispers that this is a deal, which they'll probably like even more, as long as they can pretend that that's not specifically the case. But, you know, once it's sort of explicit, then I think all of a sudden sort of the premise goes away.
So what is RFK? Let's say they do this. What even, and as you said, which I think is exactly right and also hilarious, or not hilarious, but sad, comical, and scary. Trump doesn't care who's in his cabinet. What does he give RFK, or what can RFK get?
I mean, so it's interesting. If you look at, I think Biden, first of all, I think Biden has been a very good president. I also think that he was very smart in how he dealt with his cabinet posts, in that he gave the far left positions that to him didn't really matter all that much. And he said, I'm keeping these for the centrist, older, regional people who I need. So that's the Attorney General at the Department of Justice. That is the Treasury Secretary. So it's Merrick Garland at Justice, Janet Yellen at Treasury, Secretary Austin at Defense, and Anthony Blinken at State, right? Those are the big four that really matter the most. And then there are other people like Becerra, who runs HHS, who I don't think is seen to be super competent, but, you know, that was a political pick, and so be it. He was a elected official from California who checked a bunch of boxes. So my guess is that if someone on Team Trump were thinking strategically, you would say to RFK, you can't have any of have these four, because these are the four that actually matter, though you wouldn't say that to him. You'd just say, you can't have these four already taken. Take your pick of the rest. And between his work with the River Keepers and his anti-vaccine stuff, you know, there's a few different, maybe he'd want to run the FDA, right? Maybe be HHS, maybe be EPA.
That's pretty bad news. That's
Interior. Bad news. No, it's all terrible, but this is what we're going to get in a Trump administration. So, so something like that. And then she, I think she's...
Yeah, I was going to say, what does Shanahan get?
Well, it's interesting, right? So in a way, because she seems like a much more functional person, could probably go to the White House and end up with a meaningful, influential role that probably matters more than a lot of these cabinet agencies. The problem is, she's probably too smart for that and wouldn't want to be part of just the insanity of inside the Trump world.
Also, like, closer you get to Trump, I mean, the worse it is, right?
Yeah. So for her,
the day-to-day kind of like lifestyle thing.
Yeah. So I think for her, I don't know, she had a couple of startups, so Secretary of Commerce, maybe, you know, the CTO of the country, although that's kind of part of the White House. Maybe you don't want to get too embedded with them. You know, she's a lawyer, but they're not going to make her, I mean, God forbid, attorney general. And Trump's not going to put someone in the AG job that he doesn't think will 100% do his bidding, because he needs them to drop all the federal investigations against him. But, you know, I think all of that, or... I don't know that she wants to be a judge, but they could promise her either a appellate court, which is the first one that opens, the Ninth Circuit or wherever she wants, or B, the next Supreme Court opening. Now, I think the Federalist Society has those picks already sort of lined up. But at the end of the day, you know, Trump's the boss, and even Leonard Leo, who runs the Federalist Society, if you said to him, listen, dude, you know, you can get 95% of your judges in if we, you know, if we win, or 0% of your judges in if we lose, you know, he'd cut that deal too. So there's more than enough stuff to give to both of them if they're doing this in the first place, because already they are significantly increasing the likelihood of electing Trump just by their very existence on the ballot. You put that all together, they may be willing to do this. So it, for all we know, this deal has already been cut and it's happening. But I just want to be clear that I haven't heard this anywhere. I haven't gone on message boards anywhere. I have made this up completely.
Have you ever gone on message boards anywhere? That's a non-Bradley activity.
I remember when I quit smoking weed about 8.5 months ago now, I went on a couple of groups on Reddit that I thought might be helpful with it. And the problem was the people who were on it, their lives were so radically different from mine that I just couldn't relate to them at all, you know. So it didn't work for me.
So that was it for message boards. So I want to ask one more question.
Oh, and then sometimes the Mets.
Right. Oh, you go on message boards for the Mets?
Well, I don't, you know, last I checked, they lost again today. They were losing 7-5 in the ninth. But, you know, yeah, in a good year, I'll go onto Mets blog and I might like read the comments and stuff. Yeah.
Wow. You know who Dominic Cummings is, the guy who worked for Boris Johnson?
Yeah.
You know, so I read his Substack from time to time, and it's people who I know in the UK think he's completely wackadoodle, and maybe he is, I don't know. But he was talking about something we've talked about on Firewall a bunch, about the, you know, the 100,000 or so voters who are going to decide the election the 6 or 8 swing states. And he talked about, he sort of posed it as a question more than an assertion, but how many of them are double haters, right? How many of them hate Biden and Trump, and it will just come down to the one they hate the least?
Yeah, I think there's the polling shows that seems like most Americans are double haters.
So the question is,
do they hate them enough to vote for RFK?
Is RFK a triple hate situation? Right?
I don't think he's sort of known enough to really hate.
Right. So that's his advantage in a sense, is that he sort of comes in as like there's a kind of sense of who he is, and an attraction or repulsion, maybe, who knows. But some feeling that gets attached to him.
That is why, and I know there's all these reasons, both like logistical and political, why you couldn't just swap Biden out at the convention. But if you did, it is sort of a Jedi move, because then all of a sudden let's just say it's Gretchen Whitmer, just someone that's just sort of a cipher where just no one has strong feelings about them one way or the other, right? So even Newsom, I think, would be a little risky because he's so easy to stereotype. So you put someone like that in there, and then all of a sudden you've wiped out the debt completely on the Democratic side. People will still hate Trump. Those who get to know Kennedy will probably hate him too. And then just by being the lesser of the evils, you become the salient choice.
And you, at this point, don't believe that's a realistic
possibility. And it feels like... There have been some things I've been reading lately that have been making the case as to why that's not feasible. So, you know, the best one I've seen so far, which I do think is probably right, is you would have to both pick someone at the convention and then the entire party would have to immediately coalesce around that person, right? And the problem is Democrats' infighting is so severe that the far left is going to have their person, the center is going to have their person, there'll probably be some other, there might be people from different ethnic groups that have their people. So the notion that everyone's going to immediately get behind her in a two-month span and still turn out the vote and everything else is pretty tough. And by the way, there is a risk that black voters say it was Kamala's turn if Biden wasn't the person, and by her not getting it, then that all of a sudden reduces black turnout. Whereas if she does get it, we know how unpopular she is, so that is not really an improvement over Biden. So there's a lot of risk to it. The reality is the safer play may actually be just to sort of roll the dice with Biden and hope it works out. But, you know, as this little simulation that I just went through shows, there's just a lot of different ways to go with this guy.
All right. Thank you for scaring the shit out of us, Bradley.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that.
That leads into the next topic.
Yeah, it does. And so I'll just read the headline.
Yes.
So this is a piece. It's already up on your Substack, correct?
Yep. Published last week.
So the headline is, and then I'm going to let you talk, is Trump a biblical allegory? He just might be. All right.
Yeah.
What's going on here, Brad?
So I'm going to read what I wrote, which is...
you're going to read it. Okay.
Yeah, it's not that long, I think. Okay. I think it's better than talking through. So the Bible is filled with stories of being sent from God to teach people a lesson. From countless prophets warning everyone to be better, to brutal plagues ranging from Noah's flood, to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, to the story of Moses, one way or another, God is trying to tell us something. While many of us now see these lessons as outdated, in many ways, Trump really does seem like the perfect biblical allegory. What are the lessons God may be trying to convey? First, it's the same lesson as Jesus teaches over and over in the New Testament. Money, status, power, influence, and fame neither produces nor guarantees happiness or a good life. Trump has had the most powerful job in the world. He has a lot of money, and whether it's hundreds of millions or billions, it's still a lot. He has tens of millions of followers, if not more. He is one of the most recognizable faces on the planet. He lives in total luxury with Carrara marble and fine Corinthian leather and gold plating everywhere he turns. And Trump is utterly miserable. He is always aggrieved, always hurt, always slighted. He is always at conflict, never at peace. He pursued money, status, glamour, and power at all costs, achieved it in full, and it turned out not to produce anywhere near the desired result of a happy life. It goes on. Trump schemed his way to the top. And what does it lead to? More scheming. Now he's scheming how to post the $175 million bond to the state of New York. How to avoid going to trial for treason, for election rigging, for espionage. How to beat the charges in the Stormy Daniels case. How to avoid prison. How to avoid bankruptcy. How to avoid being held accountable for all of the actions that got him the power and money and influence and status he wanted in the first place. Scheming only begets more scheming, which begets more scheming. It's not a solution. And the Trump allegory teaches us something also about the sins of his enemies. Trump has been a successful demagogue in large part because the people he appeals to feel mistreated. They feel condescended to, looked down upon. The birth of cable news and then social media created an efficient forum for someone like Trump to capitalize on that anger. So much of that frustration comes directly from the attitudes of those who see themselves as elite, people who are typically highly educated, affluent, generally non-religious, live in big cities, vote for Democrats, and are quick to look down on anyone different from them, and even quicker to lecture anyone in earshot about their moral inferiority. People do not like being told that they're lesser. They do not like being told how to think. They do not like being condescended or lectured to. The attitude of the resistance is what helped make Trump possible in the first place. Constantly looking down on your fellow human beings as inferior is no better than striving desperately for money, status, and power for the sake of nothing but money, status, and power. They're all signs of societal decay. Be forewarned, Or maybe the behavior of both Trump and his foes is the forewarning. Does all of this end with global catastrophe, with flooding and smiting and pillars of salt? It might. Another Trump term could lead to nuclear war, since stability is the greatest deterrent to mutually assured destruction. It will certainly lead to more human suffering for failing to address climate change. But maybe it also leads to a greater realization by the people that our ways are wrong. We've gotten too off course in terms of what matters and what it means to be a human being. We've put our faith in the wrong values, and Trump is the ultimate manifestation of that. I know that a biblical allegory in today's highly advanced, sophisticated modern world seems absurd, but there's an old joke that may indicate otherwise. Here's how it goes. A very religious man is living in the countryside, and the rains come. The countryside starts to flood, and it's flooding around his house. People in a small boat come by and say, "Get in the boat, you're going to drown." He says, "No, my heart is pure. God will save me, and I will wait for a message from him." The water keeps rising. The bottom half of his house floods. He goes upstairs, and he's looking out the window. A larger boat comes by with a pack of drenched people who have been flooded out of their homes. The captain says, "Get in the boat and we can save you." The man says, "No, I am waiting for God. He will save me. He will send me a message." The water keeps rising and the man is stuck on the roof. A helicopter flies over the house and drops a ladder. The pilot yells down to the man, "Climb the ladder and we can save you. You're going to drown." And the man says, "No, I'm waiting for God and he will tell me what to do." The man drowns. Now we're up at the pearly gates. The man says to God, "God, why did you forsake me? I was pure of heart and waited for your message to tell me what to do." God replies, "Tell you what to do, send you a message. I sent a boat, I sent a bigger boat, I sent a helicopter. How many messages do you need?" So that's the joke. But anyway, the point here ultimately is, as I think we just conveyed, is I think that things are, I don't know, you know, we always think that the time that we're living in is totally unique. And I think usually there are historic parallels to pretty much all of it. And I think that as much as, you know, sitting here in the middle of Manhattan, we like to sort of look down on people who, you know, consider the Bible to be an important source of knowledge, I think there's a lot in that book that is worth reading.
So one group that you didn't touch on in this, and it's a short essay, so it's not like you were covering all the ground, but you talk about the sins of his enemies. What about the sins of his enablers?
Yeah, but I think to a certain extent they're part of the same Sodom. Well, I mean, they're the part of the same Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Lot is told by God to try to get people to repent, and Lot fails, and Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed, right? So, you know, the enablers of Trump are basically Trump light, right? Trump is the ultimate sort of prophet of doom, the ultimate manifestation of what happens when you value money and power and status and glamour and fame ahead of anything else, any human quality. But they're just like that, but not as good at it.
Do you think that McConnell, McCarthy, others could have stopped him when they had the chance? They
could I mean, if you're McConnell, think about how fucking badly this played out. You could have impeached him. Clearly, if McConnell said the Senate Republicans also believe that after trying to kill us in the Capitol, he should be impeached and convicted in the Senate, then he would have been barred from running for president. Again, he couldn't have gotten on the ballot. McConnell didn't have the balls to do it. And you know what? He's leaving anyway. It's not even like he saved his own skin with it because, you know, he's not running for re-election. So he had been elected to his last term.
Did he fear then? That's what I don't understand. What did he fear?
He feared two things. He feared that in the next set of primaries, his incumbents who voted for conviction would be thrown out, and he sees his job is to protect them and also to protect his majority, to protect his status as majority leader. So he saw his power ultimately at risk.
Was that a good reading of it? Do you think
no,
that because,
well, I don't know. Right? It is hard to predict. You know, I think what you then had in 2018 and 2022, was a lot of Trump people did win primaries, a lot of crazies, and they lost. The reason why the Democrats didn't lose the Senate in 2022, even though they were expected to, is in large part because the Trump handpicked nuts won a lot of the primaries, and then those people were so out there that they lost the general elections. So I'm not sure that McConnell misread it, but I think that, you know, he is in some ways the epitome of the same thing, right? Just Mitch McConnell pursues status and power at the expense of everything else, expense of what's right and wrong, expense of human beings, expense of human lives. And ultimately, you know, he is getting what he asked for, which is his worst enemy, Trump, is coming back. He is retiring. Someone else will be Senate Majority Leader anyway. And his legacy will be in large part, like, I don't think any, Mitch McConnell, I don't think will have a legacy as anything other than a selfish man who spent decades doing what was good for him. I can't name a single legislative accomplishment of his. All he did was he was good at internal politics and good at counting votes in the Senate. And maybe there are some, you know, aficionados of sort of the inner workings of Congress who really appreciate that. But at the end of the day, for those who remember him at all, and I don't think he'll be that remembered, but for those who do, it will just be this cowardly shithead who only ever looked out for himself.
Well, I just want to, we've talked about this in the podcast before, and we had the guy on from the Big Dig podcast, but in that podcast, it's revealed that as a junior senator from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell voted to override a veto of President Reagan. So it's just such a funny, it totally supports your point, which is, I mean, he's just the most sort of political in the worst context kind of guy that you can imagine.
Yeah. And by the way, I just want to be clear, they're pretty much all like that. I do genuinely believe it. That is still the underlying precept of this entire podcast, is that every policy output is shaped by political input. But he is the extreme.
I just think it's interesting if you get the inputs wrong, right?
Which I think he did. You know, but the input he really got wrong was his own fallibility. If he didn't have sort of what seems like these mini series of strokes during press conferences, which looked, made him look totally debilitated, then... You know, it probably would be that the Republicans are going to win the Senate this year and that he would go on staying in power. So, you know, the input he got wrong actually was himself, not the underlying politics.
Right. Are we ready for a hard pivot?
Hard pivot.
Are we going to hard pivot to our beleaguered Mayor Adams and his move on autonomous vehicles. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so this combines two of our, you know, it feels like ultimately there's like four or five topics on this podcast we talk about regularly. We talk about national politics, we talk about New York City politics, we talk about tech regulation, we talk about kind of wellness and happiness and all of that. And then I kind of missed the fifth, but kind of maybe the economy, behavioral economics, that kind of stuff. But that wasn't what
was
in my head.
You also talk about books a lot, but maybe
that's books, yeah, but neither of those were what was in my head. And sports, when you allow me to. so this combines two of them, tech regulation and New York City. So the administration issued some permits to allow for testing of autonomous vehicles here in the city, which I think is a very good move. And I would say, generally speaking, Adams has been an incredibly pro-tech mayor. Here's the thing. So Mike was the ultimate pro-tech mayor in that he supported all these policies, and then they actually worked on them. So he helped build out the tech community in New York City, the tech economy in New York City, and they actually helped create, you know, what led to hundreds of thousands of jobs, as well as the Cornell Technion campus on Roosevelt Island that will lead ultimately to hundreds of thousands more. De Blasio then in all ways positioned himself as the anti-Mike, and that included being the anti-tech mayor. He hated tech. I think when he tried to take out Uber and we cut his favorability in half, that he sort of didn't make him like tech anymore than he did before. Famously would only use a flip phone, total Luddite. And then Adams is sort of in the middle, whereas he's very pro-tech. He has the right policies, which I think this is true of Adams in general, right? Which is, you know, if you said, I want a mayor who is pro-business, pro-tech, pro-education reform, pro-law enforcement, pro-quality of life. You know, those are all things that he is, right? Which at least lines up with my views pretty well. The problem is he is so insanely incompetent. The people he appoints are so insanely lackluster beyond what seems like also a corruption motivation to half of what he does. Nothing ever actually gets done. So I was talking to someone at one of the self-driving car companies about this the other day, and I just said, look, it's great that you got him to do this. My advice to you is you have to do not take their word for anything. You have to be on City Hall and DOT about this every fucking day, and it's going to piss them off because ultimately they're going to feel like you're doubting their competence and their integrity, which you are. But if you don't do that, so Yordanis Rodriguez is the transportation commissioner in New York City, longtime city councilman, total political hack, just completely political. That's it. Runs the agency, you know, as if he is just like a local political hack. In fact, when Adams, in his State of the City a few months ago, one of his big ideas, there weren't many, was to have a new agency to deal with e-bike and scooter fires, battery fires. And like that was clearly a transportation issue that should be part of transportation. And by saying a new agency, what they were saying is even we have so little faith in our own guy that if we have anything new to do, we're just going to put it somewhere else, right? So one is, you know, they've got to really be on top of it. But, you know, the most of the criticism I've seen of this, and State Senator John Liu has been pretty vocal about it, is based on sort of safety concerns, and it's not unreasonable. But I think there's a few points that we should remember. Number one is the level of safety accountability that we hold autonomous vehicles to compared to human drivers is so wildly disparate that it makes no sense, right? Every 15 minutes, someone in this country is killed in a car accident. That's killed, right? Forget about all the other injuries, you know, people getting hurt, lives getting ruined, property getting destroyed, everything else, which just happens around the clock. An autonomous vehicle like nudges over the yellow line by 3 inches, and all of a sudden it's a giant scandal, and it's too dangerous, and we can't have it. Human beings are bad drivers. Human beings are extremely fallible. And in fact, I am a bad driver, but you know what makes me in some ways a better driver than most people? I know that I'm a bad driver. I recognize it. So I drive really carefully because I know I'm terrible at it. Most people think that they're really good drivers, and the reality is they're not. And that's why so many people die on the roads and there's so many accidents. And so, one, in a world of fully autonomous vehicles, we would just have far fewer accidents, far fewer fatalities, far fewer everything. Two, if you think about some of like congestion pricing, which is an issue that you've been interested in a lot lately, the ostensible purpose of congestion pricing is to reduce congestion in Manhattan, to increase the speed of vehicles going cross town, east-west. Right. And do you know what would significantly speed up the flow of traffic and reduce congestion? If all cars were autonomous, because then they could all be driving at a much higher speed and all doing synchronicity with each other and the lights and everything else, and you would be able to meaningfully improve traffic flow. So if your goal, now I think the goal of congestion pricing is just to put a new tax on commuters to put more money into the MTA. Right, right. So that is what it's about. But if the goal were actually about trying to reduce congestion itself, you have a solution in autonomous driving that if you got there faster, wouldn't have to cost people from, you know, the boroughs and the suburbs and everything else anything. And by the way, wouldn't cost the government anything either, right?
No, and there's a huge economic benefit of increasing the flow of traffic.
Yeah, productivity, everything. And the other thing would be, you know, lately, you know, New York City's airports have gotten better. LaGuardia, Lyle and I flew out of the Delta Terminal. I hadn't been in that one in a while. It was really nice. Terminal B, which is the one that they rebuilt, that was the one that Biden had called a third world country airport, is really nice. Newark has Terminal A now, which is really nice. So there's a lot of improvement. What we still don't have is a single ride on mass transit to the airports, right? You have these sort of multimodal, take a subway to a commuter train to another train. Like, you know, Abby and I took the train to JFK a couple of months ago because we were leaving at 5 o'clock on a weekday and I was afraid of just getting stuck. But we took four separate trains from my apartment until we got to JetBlue. And so that doesn't work either. Maybe it wasn't JetBlue, but whatever the terminal was. So if you were to have fully autonomous vehicle deployment, you would get to the airports a lot faster, right? So if you could cut that time from Midtown to JFK at 5 o'clock on a weekday from anywhere from an hour and a half to 3 hours to a reliable 35 minutes, then all of a sudden, you know what? You don't need to spend tens of billions of dollars in public taxpayer money, money that could go to better schools, could go to higher quality of life, could go to better healthcare, could just stay in people's pockets and put it back in the economy. You wouldn't need to do any of that because, you know, you would be able to just actually let technology and the market work as it should, and it would solve the problem for you. And so I don't know that Adams is thinking about a world of, you know, reduced time to the airport, less, you know, no need for congestion pricing. And these are all things that wouldn't happen until he's out of office. And it's very rare that a politician ever has a policy that they think about or care about that would take place when they're out of office. But I do think that, you know, the ultimate goal of moving towards autonomous vehicles is that some of our underlying biggest challenges when it comes to infrastructure and mass transit are best addressed by having fully autonomous cars. And so at least credit to Eric Adams and his administration for moving this step forward. I think in their case, trust but verify is important. So I'm not going to actually, you know, give them any credit until they get something done. But at least in their first step, pretty good.
Well, I just want to add a slightly bigger point to that, which I think you'll agree with, but I want you to hear what you think. You know, in a bigger picture too, beyond just autonomous vehicles, both the city and the Adams administration need a bigger story, right? Like they do not have a good story to tell at the moment. And if they talk about autonomous vehicles in the way that you're talking about, which is a true improvement in living in the city, you know, that's not just like, oh, we want to, you know, make it easier for tech bros to start.
I don't know that in fairness, I love that because it would fit with my vision of the world.
Right.
It probably doesn't reach likely or even potential primary voters. And because reporters believe that to be, you know, good progressives, they have to be anti-tech. I don't think that they're going to carry the message all that well, you know, which is why, as we've said in this podcast a million times, it's all about quality of life, right? It's about closing the illegal weed shops, tearing down all the scaffolding, getting all the mentally ill people off the subways and streets, you know, stopping people from injecting fentanyl into their toes, you know, on the sidewalk, doing something about all the shoplifting in every store. You know, that's what people want to see. But could there be a technological component to that? Yes. And if it was part of a broader, we're going to make your day-to-day life better, we're going to make the city run better, then I think it could be incorporated into a broader narrative.
Let's talk about Atlanta and your recommendations.
Yeah, so I've got a few recommendations, and it's sort of an anti-recommendation too. It's not a negative; it's an anti.
Have we done an anti-recommendation before?
Yes, we have. Although not quite in the nature of this one. So the first thing, actually, before Atlanta, have you listened to the Beyonce country album?
I have not yet.
It's fantastic. Yeah. It is I do too. But it is so good. I mean, I probably listened to it full now 3 or 4 times since it came out on Friday. It is just, I can't, I mean, it's not like I'm unearthing some hidden gem here. It's fucking Beyonce. Everyone's aware of it. But like at the same time, it is really just, it's excellent. So to the extent that you're thinking about listening to it, I would recommend it.
Yeah.
Second is a TV show. I don't know if you're looking for anything to watch on the flight back to New York, but it probably actually would be about the entirety of your flight, is a show on Netflix called The Three-Body Problem. Have you heard of this?
I've started it, and I like it a lot.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So it's a sci-fi show made by the people who made Game of Thrones, and it is effectively about communication with aliens on another planet and sort of the risk of attracting their attention. And then we've attracted their attention, and now there's a problem, and what are we going to do about it?
Do you know what Three-Body Problem is, by the way? Like, where, you know, it's probably the single greatest contribution to, you know, kind of world culture that China has in terms of like cultural stuff.
Why don't you explain it?
Oh, should I explain? I don't know that much more about it than that. I just know.
Because I can't explain it either. That's why I turned it over to you.
In fact, part of the reason I'm watching the show is because I've always wanted to read. I think there's more than one book, but they're dense and somewhat hard to get through. Although,
Look, having watched the show, I still couldn't really define the three-body problem. But I think the underlying gist of it is that you can't sort of solve for one problem like the positioning of the sun or the moon or whatever it is, and then count on that to determine how the Earth is going to fare, because you are interacting with so many other celestial bodies that there's never sort of the ability to isolate just one problem. I think is sort of the gist of it, but I could be wrong.
Well, look, I agree with you completely. It's the first TV show I've watched in a while where I was like hooked, completely hooked.
Yeah, so highly recommended. Third would be, and this isn't a content, but City of Atlanta. Especially if you're like a teenager and you're looking for like a full 2.5 day trip, Lyle and I went to Atlanta and we had a blast. It was a really great city and it was a really good mix of stuff to do. We went there because we talked about before, Lyle's really interested in rap. And Atlanta is sort of the rap epicenter of the U.S. right now. And we went on a hip-hop tour of Atlanta and saw a lot of cool stuff. We saw, like, where Young Thug grew up and where Outkast recorded their first album and Little Baby's childhood home and, you know, all of these things. They have all these really cool murals. We have photos of me and Lyle in front of the MF Doom mural, in front of the Outkast mural. So that was great. We went to the Trap Museum, which was surprisingly very fun. I recommend it. It's like a 25, 30 minutes at most, unless you want to drink. They have a bar that was fucking packed and looked like fun. The problem is you had a 15-year-old who doesn't drink and a 50-year-old who doesn't drink in our group, so didn't do much. But it did look fun. And then same thing on civil rights, right? So we went to Ebenezer Baptist Church. We went to MLK's tomb. We went stopped by we couldn't go in, but the home he lived in with Coretta and the kids. We went by the home that he lived in as a child. And then a lot of other cool stuff. Went to the Hawks game. Got some more rap stuff in there. 2 Chainz was sitting right in front of us. Killer Mike was across the court. So that was exciting. And I have to say, it was Hawks Hornets, so two totally not playoff teams. Good crowd, good atmosphere, good arena. Like, all things considered, I was pretty impressed.
Coach of the Hawks, right?
He is. And he's got those distinctive Sally Jesse Raphael red glasses. And, you know, we were actually right next to the Hawks bench. So I was watching him coach. So that was – because there really weren't any great players in the game because Trae Young and LaMelo Ball were both out. So, you know, there was Brandon Williams. There was DeJounte Murray. A few guys here or there, but nothing that exciting. But with all that said, still really fun time. The Georgia Aquarium. I love aquariums. Lyle does not. And I would say that he would agree that at least for an aquarium, it wasn't that bad. We went to the High Museum of Art, which is their big, you know, a fine art museum. Fine, pretty good, saw a few things, you know, wouldn't make a special trip. We went to the Carter Presidential Library, which was kind of
you
a lot.
You did all this in 2.5 days?
Yeah, we were fucking packed, man. Which was a lot like the Carter administration, just kind of drab. In fact, Lyle said to me at one point, and Lyle's been to a few, Lyle really likes history, and I've been with him to FDR, JFK, and LBJ presidential libraries, all pretty consequential presidents, right? Who just a lot, either did a lot or a lot at least happened in the time they were president. He looks at me and Carter goes, he didn't do very much, did he? And I said, what makes you say that? He goes, none of this really, and they're saying a lot of things, but none of it seems that important. And he was right. Like, they had a big thing on the Panama Canal. He didn't build the Panama Canal. He like updated the treaty, right? Like, it was all stuff like that. They spun his sort of two big failures pretty cleverly, I thought. One was that they spun the oil crisis and the shortage as him creating our first sustainable energy policy ever, and that all of our policy since is the result of it. And the second was the hostage crisis. They just made it sound like he's the one that rescued the hostages, that he took this sort of bold moral stance to not bomb Iran because they would have killed the 42 hostages, and eventually he was proven right, and they were released, which is true. They kind of left out the fact that it happened the day after Ronald Reagan was elected president because he was going to bomb the shit out of Tehran, and the Iranians were afraid, and they didn't want that to happen. And so they kind of spun those two things. You know, there was the Egyptian-Israeli peace between Sadat and Begin, I think, was legit, right? And has held. So that was a real accomplishment. But there weren't that many. Now, his post-presidency, in terms of the work that he did on behalf of humanity, was very impressive. But at the end of the day, you know, what matters is the presidency itself. So we did that. We went to a famous cemetery. We went on the Beltline, which is kind of like their High Line. And then we had a ton of great food. We probably each came home with like gout and 30 points higher cholesterol, triglycerides. But we went to soul food. We had Caribbean food. We had barbecue. We had Cajun food. And it was fucking great. So all a long way of saying, and it's an hour and 45-minute flight from New York. And it's, you know what? It's like also that from Chicago. It's sort of weirdly only a couple of hours from anywhere in the U.S. pretty good place to kill a couple of days with your kid.
Right.
So here's the ante, which actually fits quite nicely, even though I didn't do it this way on purpose, into the Atlanta conversation. So there's this book by Jonathan Eich that we've talked about before. Maybe you've read it. I haven't. It came out about MLK last year. Did you read it?
I've not read it, no.
But you're aware of it.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
I read the reviews.
Right. It won. Right. You're I don't read books, but I read literary criticism guy. From Metropolis. Yeah, I know. So I wrote this esteemed, acclaimed biography of MLK. It came out last year, won every imaginable award. He even came to our friend Howard's got a book group that, which by the way, I wasn't aware of it until Howard mentioned this, which means neither you nor I are invited to this book group. But I apparently came and spoke to their book group. And it's a great book, but I gotta say, and this is just a larger point about biographies, if it wasn't so acclaimed, I would have given up. Because he took 150 pages to talk about King's childhood. It's too much for me, man. I don't care. What I've realized with biographies is I want to read about the things that made me want to read about them in the first place. So it wasn't really till part two when we got to Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott that anything started to happen. And now that we're in it, book's really good. But it took 150 pages of stuff that, yes, I understand broadly speaking. It shapes context. It helps you understand his motivations, his psychological influences, all of that. Fine. Here's my question, I guess. And I don't have an answer to this. I'm just posing the question out there. I'm curious what the listeners think, which is this just me and that most people read biographies really like the childhood stuff and therefore I just sort of have a lack of substantive discipline? Or do biographies lose readers all the time because either they stop reading because they don't want 150 pages about someone's childhood, or they don't read it in the first place because it's going to be boring. And the reason it's going to be boring is because every biography they start is boring because they're all about someone's childhood at first.
One answer, and I feel like probably you did this yourself, right, is you just cruise through it, right? So you realize, oh shit, we're going to be stuck here for a long time. So rather than
but kept going,
it sounds tiresome as hell, but I just mean I think, first of all, I think the number of people who read big books like this is incredibly small. But
our listeners probably do. Yeah.
You have to be strategic about it. You have to realize well, there is a reason I want to read this and probably the good parts really are good. And I'm just going to take those 150 pages on his childhood. I'm going to do them in 45 minutes,
Yeah, I guess so. I just, generally speaking, I don't read that many biographies. And I think the reason why is because of the childhood piece. I want to read about the thing that made them seem worth reading about in the first place. I don't know if there's a way to restructure the biography where it's in the back and you're if you want more, here's the first 150 that can help you understand so-and-so's influences.
Well, it's an interesting thing, right? Because there have been at various points efforts to make sort of short literary biographies, that are 200 pages. And there's some great examples. The one about Mayor Daley in Chicago by Mike Royko is
that's a great book.
130 pages or something. You know, it's there's not 150 pages on his childhood for sure. So anyway, people like the big, immerse yourself in every last detail kind of approach.
I guess it's just me, but I would say, and this, I guess I'm part of the publishing industry, right? In a way.
Yeah, you are.
I'll ask people at publishing houses this question, but are they sure that they don't lose readers or deter readers simply because definitionally the beginning of almost every biography is inherently boring?
Let's ask some people.
Yeah. Good. So now we've been waving to the people. We've been, people are waving back to us. There's no fight. There's people, last time there was a brawl when we were out here. This time it's just lots and lots of people. This club,
you're talking about the line outside.
The line, back to the line. The club must be enormous because people have just been, the line moves fast and people have been the whole time just kind of flooding in. I guess we don't see the exit, so maybe they're coming out at a faster pace than we realize. Oh, Basil's shaking his head. No. Have you been up there, Basil? You have. How big is it?
It's decent. It takes over the whole roof of the hotel.
Got it. And then what do they have, like 30 bartenders? Because, I mean, it just, I mean, all these people are coming in. I assume they're drinking hard, right? The point of having the place is to sell them alcohol and make money. So, but they also be coming in at once.
Yeah.
So are they waiting like 20 minutes for a drink, or are they just like, it's just like a, like 10 bars with like five people working at each bar?
I think it's just one big bar. I've only been there once though.
They Bradley, also have, we're just going to have to settle this by going up there ourselves one night.
You know, it's funny. I was about to say I can't get in, but it seems pretty clear that anybody can get in if you go at 5:30. So maybe I'll have to step inside.
Tune in next week for more about Mr. Purple.
Tales from Mr. Purple.
Tales from Mr. Purple.
Report, I'll bring back a report on the bar. All right. I think that covers it.
See you next week, Bradley.
See ya.